Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Matt Kinnear, Dan Abern, and Jeff Shannon, and we are talking about the 2017 college lacrosse season. We are very fired up to do so. We are looking at it through the lens of what did we get right, what did we get wrong, looking all the way back to the preseason expectations that we set in creating the 2017 Faceoff Yearbook. Dan, you and Kyle Devitt deep dove in December into the Faceoff Yearbook rankings, All-Americans, all the like, and it was really interesting conversation. I remember there was a lot of Star Wars talk as well. So now TBT. that's on demand and on DVD, it gives you a little bit of context as to how long this has been coming, this podcast, where we hold ourselves accountable to what we got right, what we got wrong. But before we dive in, we're going to talk about storylines, the lifeblood of a college lacrosse season, what happened and how did we react to it. So, Dan, we're going to kick it to you. You are going to give us some thoughts, and we are going to give you our reactions.
Yeah. In my opinion, the biggest storyline of this season was the emergence of the Big Ten. We had three Big Ten teams ranked number one at one point, Maryland, Penn State, and Rutgers. Ohio State was consistently top-ranked, and even Michigan was top 20 at one point during the season, I believe. So, really, I just thought it was a great year for the Big Ten. What led to some of those other teams not named Maryland and Hopkins closing the gap earlier than I think a lot of people expected?
Yeah, so for me, like, this kind of comes down to the identity of the conference and what it meant when in 2013 they announced that they were going to play a men's lacrosse season, and then in 2015 when they took the field for the first time, right? And so, like, I remember at the time talking to people who kind of didn't think it was that big of a deal and saying, if that's the way you feel, I think the problem is you don't understand the power of the Big Ten brand and what it means for these institutions to be a part of it in terms of access to resources, the way that they compete with each other, and everything that goes along with it. And I think it immediately showed itself to be true in 2015 when Hopkins and Maryland went to the Final Four, Ohio State made it to the quarterfinals. So three of the last eight teams alive were Big Ten teams. I think that, you know, 2016 represented a little bit of a step back, but in 2017, you know, it was Big Ten dominance to the degree that we haven't seen before. Obviously, you mentioned the three teams having been ranked number one. One of them didn't even end up making the NCAA tournament. Certainly, there's a lot to unpack there. But my thing is that, you know, in Ohio State represents the model, the paradigm, I think, because making it to the NCAA championship game, you know, it kind of represented the crescendo of the investment. So Gene Smith has done a lot to promote lacrosse within that athletic department. They've given Coach Nick Myers a lot of resources, and there's still a lot of room to grow. But there's access to resources that don't exist at most other athletic departments in the country because of the size. And that's not true at places like Rutgers, Michigan, and Penn State. And so what Ohio State did this year is repeatable at those three places, in my opinion.
Yeah, Dan, I think when you kind of initially talked about this question, you said the emergence of the Big Ten. And, you know, my thing is the Big Ten, we knew they were going to be good. This is not a surprise, I don't think, to anybody. You know, there's one point is, and I'll just say this as one sentence, the people who talk Big Ten versus ACC, what is the better conference? I hate that argument. I think it's stupid. I just think it's a discussion that doesn't really hold any weight. It's not interesting to me because teams win championships, conferences don't win championships. I just don't like the which conference is better argument. But getting back to the Big Ten, you know, all of these teams in the Big Ten, we had Maryland and Hopkins, which if there is any fact that you're going to say about the Big Ten's emergence, it's the fact that it's not just those two teams kind of on top with every team a step behind them. Ohio State making to the championship game, Penn State being number one, Rutgers being number one at one point. But, you know, Ohio State, Penn State, and Rutgers are teams that we've expected them to be on kind of the upswing. I remember writing about Rutgers when they were in the Big East. They beat Army, you know, in a big early season contest years ago that I thought was kind of the moment where they started to show their upward ascension. And, you know, this has been something that's building for years for them. Penn State's another team. We had them on the cover. Terry, you'll know this offhand. When do we have them on the cover? Penn State?
I want to say 12.
Yeah, I read that feature story, 12 or 13, somewhere around there. It was a year, we did it the year after they had just missed the NCAA tournament under Tamburoni.
Yeah.
When Tamburoni's like first or second year, they lost out to Princeton for that pick. Which kind of, when we get to my point, that's kind of plays into it. But yeah, that was around that time.
So I guess just overall, none of this is that big of a surprise to me. I do think the one aspect of this that's the most interesting is kind of what Terry hit on, and you know, his story in the July issue of Inside Lacrosse about Ohio State and all of the other factors that going to building a program and the approach that they do is the very interesting part about this Big Ten discussion. But, you know, it's really not surprising for me to see that Ohio State finally broke through. Penn State was very good and kind of, you know, as they've done, and, you know, they cooled off late. Johns Hopkins was very good, you know, but this year they were a non-factor when it came to tournament time. You know, Rutgers was number one, and then they didn't make the tournament, and whether or not you want to get fully into that discussion of whether they should have or not is another podcast. Michigan is kind of the team that I think a lot of people point to when they say the Big Ten has finally arrived, because Michigan was above 500. You know, they beat Penn as their kind of out-of-conference signature win, but they were still winless in the conference and really didn't make much noise outside of that. So, yes, the Big Ten, with Ohio State kind of the tip of the spear and Maryland winning the national championship, showed a lot, but, you know, it's not really surprising to me at all.
I made that point about competition, and it's just something to consider. Michigan had, they finished above 500, as Matt said. They had the biggest, they had the best season in program history, and they fired their coach at the end of it because it wasn't good enough. Just think about what that means in the landscape of college athletics and how important it is to compete.
It's interesting you brought up that cover story that we did. I think one of the things that the Big Ten did this year was establish itself as a true multi-bid league when it comes to at-large bids. So, you know, when the ACC comparison comes in, when it, we're looking at those type of things, are you a one-bid league, or do you have multiple teams that can make the NCAA tournament? I think Big Ten has established itself that. Thinking back to even those Ivy League picks, you go back 10 years ago, and Harvard's, you know, would make it as a second team because of SOS. Now that's going to be your Ohio State or your Penn State. I think the other factor to their success this year goes into their exposure, their ability to use the brand names that we know that have really a lot of cachet in sport, and to use a television network. You're on TV a lot. That exposes you to high-quality kids, kids when they were looking to commit, and or especially with some of these programs to transfer, to give you that extra edge when it comes to a run. That exposure was huge for them, and I think it'll continue to solidify them as a multi-big league and a league that will continue to compete at that top level.
And it's not just about being a multi-bid league. All four of them hosted first-round games. I mean, they were comfortably a four-bid league, you know, and the idea of them being a five, maybe a six-bid league at some point in the realm of possibility, the Big Ten has arrived. I mean, there's no question about it. They're the bully on the block.
All right, guys, let's move on to my second storyline of the season, which was Albany. The Great Danes had one of their most successful seasons ever, and they did it without a Thompson on the roster. Their season included an NCAA first-round home game and subsequent victory. So what was your reaction to the Danes? Do you feel like this really validates the direction that Scott Maher is taking the program?
I definitely think it does validate. You know, I wrote the story about their positive approach and kind of the it's a decade in the making that they've kind of taken this outlook that, you know, one of their assistants told me that, you know, if a guy drops a ball in practice and someone says, come on, like, you know, they can't do that. You know, that's just kind of a really positive reinforcement approach that they've done. It comes from Scott Maher. It comes from their assistants who played under Scott Maher. So, you know, really you can see it's paid off. But I think the thing that shows that it's paid off is not just this year in terms of their on-the-field success, which has been great, but just the ability that they've had over the past 10 years to be consistently good. I told this story once before, but they played Syracuse in the first round last year, and someone said something about Lyle Thompson putting them on the map. And, you know, this was in the first round last year, a year after Lyle Thompson graduated from the program. And, you know, Scott Maher kind of, like, gave one of those looks like, you know, we've been on the mat, but, you know, like, it's kind of like, we were in the tournament. We hosted a tournament game a decade ago. You know, they've consistently been the top team in the America East, you know, give or take a few kind of lean years there that they had. So I don't think they get credit enough for their consistency. Obviously, this year was another level. T.D. Irlen was just the X factor no pun intended, that they needed to kind of get over that hump. It was very disappointing, though, the way that their season ended. I do not think they played their best game in the quarterfinal against Maryland. And it doesn't take away from the special season that they had. But, you know, it was truly a fun one to watch, and that's just the way they do and the way that they coach.
To me, the thing about it that's most validating is what happened away from the field, really in the stands. I think that in 2016, we saw Barstool Sports sink their teeth into this Albany team. And in that respect, it was like a reflection of the fun-loving, positive attitude style, right? Like, you know, the fact that they had a shirtless team photo was the goofiest manifestation of the approach that Scott Maher has adopted for this program. Now, when you see three crowds, two night games, one in a driving rainstorm, you know, that were more than, I don't know what the Maryland midday Wednesday crowd was, probably like 3,500, but it was good. It was a really good crowd, and they were hosting a top-ranked team in the country. And then the Yale game was awesome, nearly sold out. And then the North Carolina game did sell out like 6,500 seats or whatever. Like that, you know, this has been a podcast with takes that are far too cold. I'm going to throw out a hot take right now. Albany has the second best fan support in college lacrosse behind Loyola. And that is really substantial. I mean, it's a seismic shift for, you know, a sport where Hopkins and Syracuse dominated the fan support for 50 years. Well, maybe not 50 years in Syracuse's case, but for 25 years. And now Loyola and Albany have, in my opinion, firmly entrenched themselves as one and two, probably Denver at number three. So Hopkins and Syracuse are lagging behind in that respect, in my opinion.
I think Maryland fans will tell you about the attendance record this year, that they were the number one team in attendance. Dan Abram, I can see you smirking over there.
Sure, but, that's what I say to that.
But the best games that I've been to since I've been at Inside the Cross have all been Albany games. The North Carolina game, the Notre Dame quarterfinal loss that was at Hofstra, and then even that Maryland game was up there as one of the best games that I've been to. Best atmosphere, you know, encapsulating the game on the field and the entirety of the atmosphere. Jeff?
It's interesting that you bring up those three teams, Terry, because I was going to say my one mental, I don't say issue, thought with Albany is that I think when I think about them as a program, I immediately compare them to the other top mid-majors, your Loyolas and Denvers. The one thing that Loyola and Denver have is consistency when it comes to making Final Four appearances and champion. And, you know, each one of them has won a championship in the last seven or so years. That is kind of where I think some people would like to, you know, I'm with you, Matt. I think they've actually been consistently good for, you know, a long time. It would be nice to see that consistency play itself out into a run to the Final Four and get that story done. Again, to me, it's a great story, and I really like Albany, but I'm always mentally comparing them to the other top mid-majors in their run, and Loyola's done it, Denver's done it. I like to see Albany to live up to its fulfillment and make that run.
I think the entire college lacrosse world would, and I certainly know that the Albany coaching staff would. You know, they probably more than any other program have knocked on the door and not broken through. With two quarterfinal overtime losses.
This is going way off topic, but this kind of brings me back to a tweet that I thought was really good that Jeff had during championship weekend about Maryland ending the championship drought and how North Carolina ended its championship drought last year, and kind of what is that like storyline that we've heard ad nauseum that is going to be the next one to end. Maybe Albany, you know, getting over that quarterfinal hump is one of the big ones that we have to look forward to in these next few years.
Yeah, and I think that 2018 will probably be a really special year for Albany. Like, looking at everything they return, you got the best offensive player in the country in Connor Fields. You got a guy who's winning 70% of his faceoffs. You get a blue chip recruit in Tahoka Nanacoat joining you guys, and you have a whole bunch of returners on the defensive end, plus everybody who contributes in the middle of the field. I think it's going to be a big year. I would put them in my way too early number one spot.
Well, and that certainly would set the expectation for getting over the quarterfinal hump.
All right, let's move on to my third storyline, and that is the Tewarton Award. Heading into the postseason, it kind of seemed like a two-horse race between Connor Fields and Trevor Baptiste Wynn, and then there's Rambo right there with the most ground to gain via postseason play. Rambo wins it after 20 points, kind of a quiet championship weekend, but definitely kind of felt like this year's award reaffirmed that notion that postseason play is really the determining factor of who wins this thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the way that the award is structured, it clearly, I don't know, that feels like a pot shot to me because characterizing that way, because the regular season determines who the five guys that can win the award are. Mm-hmm. The postseason determines who the one guy of those five that wins the award is. And that was after a 3 or 4 year stretch where, you know, the winner did not play on championship weekend between, you know, Peter Baum, Lyle and Miles, and then Lyle Thompson, and then last year Miles Jones. So, you know, I agree with you that it was a return to form with respect to that. But I also think that when you analyze Rambo's case among the other candidates, not in a postseason or regular season, but in a regular season through the end of the postseason form, his gap is not nearly as wide as it was at the end of the regular season. And arguably it would be the best because not only did he play really well in the tournament, but Connor Fields and Trevor Baptiste didn't play as well as their regular season standard had established.
Yeah, I mean, was there any doubt that this was a award where the postseason weighed heavily? I mean, I don't think so.
I would counter that with saying that maybe in the last couple of years we started to award the really prolific goal scorers as opposed to really, I think, the last year where we said, oh, the postseason was totally what this was about with Steele Stamick winning in 2011. And then what we saw with Peter Baum, the Thompsons, and Dylan Malloy was a shift towards more, oh, this guy is scoring a bunch of goals. He's clearly the best player in the country.
I guess it begs the question.
I'm sorry, you're right about that. I thought that for whatever reason, I had Miles Jones winning the Torden last year in my head.
it's an interesting point. Sorry, Pete, I totally forgot you won the Torden that one year, which would have been the
12th
Loyola 12 year. Where they lost to UMass.
Well, that's one of those things where
it's an interesting point that I hadn't thought about until you just brought that up.
Like, but those years have had a transcendent player who like was a clear number. I mean, the one that would be the argument would be Lusby, right? In terms of
if he had been a finalist in place of Mike Sawyer, he probably would have won the award.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also wonder if Miles Jones was a junior or senior or not, freshman and sophomore, those Duke runs that he would have, someone like that would have been competitive for the spot as well, making a run to the title game.
But I mean, I guess it begs the question, how else would you structure the way the award is given out? You know, I like the final, you know, I like the five finalists. I think it's a good structure for the event. You know, if you've ever been to the event, it's kind of a nice size and a good way to honor, you know, those guys and what they did for their accomplishments. I don't know how you would kind of structure the award in a way that, you know, maybe you do the five finalists after the championship and then have the event a week later. I don't think that really works. I love the way that the event is structured. I love the way that the award awards you for having a great regular season. It gets you to that dinner, which is a fun thing, but then, you know, you kind of got to give that extra little bit at the end, you know, to kind of separate and make your case if you have a tight group like we did this year.
I agree. I think that one of the things I like about the structure is that being a finalist is an award in and of itself, and I think that that's worthwhile. I think it's worth it to say if you are a top five player, you get something that might not necessarily be as austere and prestigious as being the best player, the top one player, but still better than, you know, the next best 45 players. And I think that that's a worthwhile endeavor that they undertake, and the way it's structured is good. I also think, you know, if you were going to argue for doing it after the first round of the quarterfinals, I would oppose that because I do think that there's something about like the cleanliness of everybody having an equal shot at being a finalist that is worthwhile.
Yeah, I get with that. The one thing I would maybe play with is the arbitrariness of having five finalists. If that year warrants six, I'm cool with that. If that year warrants four, I'm cool with that.
And the Heisman has adapted that after, I think, being a little bit more rigorous with the number of finalists that they brought to New York. And I don't know, I like it, you know, and correct if I'm wrong, has the Oscars done that as well now with Best
Oscars
Picture?
Oscars opened itself up to 10. It went from 5 to 10.
And it has never been fewer than 10 since the expansion?
It's been 10. I don't remember a year where they've been like, it's not. That was, again, to offer more inclusiveness and it's more Hollywood-y things. But, and that's why I say some years I would say, if it's four, it's four. If it's six, it's six. The arbitrariness of five always just seemed like you're boxing yourself in for no particular reason. You're creating the rules for this. Why not?
It's a base 10 society, Jushan. It's half a 10. So we're comparing the Torten to the Heisman and the Oscars and talking about
well, I mean that's what it is. It's the same thing. Yeah.
No, I think it's an important point that I think maybe if it's less, it should be less. If it needs to be 6 or 7, let it be 6 or 7. Because I feel like this year we all kind of had that conversation when the finalists came out that said, hey, this guy's a snub. I know for me personally, it was Sergio Salcido. I thought he should have been there considering how important he was to his team and all the clutch moments that he delivered. But, you know, that's an argument to have at another point maybe. All right, guys, let's move on to my fourth storyline of the season, one that I don't think any of us saw coming, but the year of the freshman. It was a near unprecedented year for rookies. We had some early bloomers in Dox Akin, Mack O'Keefe, Gerard Arceri, and then some late bloomers in guys like Jeff Teat and Trey LeClaire. But I think the one unanimous thing we can say is that Michael Sowers had the best freshman season out of all of them. He looks to be on pace for an all-time great career, and I think Trey LeClaire was very close behind him with the way he emerged late in the season, helped the Buckeyes get to a national title game.
I think, Jishan, you're the person to best speak to what the class overall expectations were in terms of, like, what was the reputation of this group relative to other classes in recent memory? And then there's another, like, kind of ancillary storyline, which is how impactful were the U19s?
I was going to say, I think what's interesting about this class is how many of them were involved with some high-level events leading up to it. Also, it's a weird class because for some reason, maybe sort of a premonition of this group, but we profiled a lot of these kids in a series that we did a couple of years ago, looking at that just this class and some of the interesting stories that came out of it, and they sort of came to fruition in this. You mentioned the U19s when they had those tryouts. I mean, anybody under, I forget what the age cutoff is, but it's usually a lot of college freshmen, guys who would be in that group or going into the college. With this unit, with the US U19s, you saw several high schoolers make it. It was Dox. It was Sowers.
Bernhardt.
Bernhardt was on the team.
Arceri.
Arceri is that crew.
Phil Gossip Brown.
Gossip Brown, who, again, we were talking about late bloomer. I want to say he came on late for...
He had a better year. I mean, his stats were a function more, I think, of Brown's defensive approach and how difficult it was going to be for that group to adopt a very different system from what Lars had left behind when he moved on to Virginia.
Yeah, but anyways, so this group has been tested. They've been playing in high-profile events.
Been coached by college coaching staff.
Coached by college coaching staffs. They played on a winning team. I watched that whole tournament, which was crazy. And just the talent that was shown. Again, these guys were beating out college players to earn these spots. And even on the Canadian side, someone like Trey LeClaire had a great tournament. Ethan Walker earned all tournament honors. Jeff Teat should have earned all tournament honors at that event.
He broke John Grant Jr.'s scoring record in juniors. So like
juniors. So again, these are guys that had a lot of stats coming up from underneath them, and not arbitrary stats. And so to see them perform on the field in the way they did, I mean, Sowers, one of my favorite stories was covering him with the Under Armour underclass games a couple years ago on a really talented Philly team that had Docs, that had one of our guys, Matt Moore. He was the leader of that team, played that whole week, was so dehydrated they had to go to the hospital and take IVs for the next week, and they came back and played in the U19 stuff. So, great kid, great story there. I'm not shocked at all that he had the opportunity to perform at the level that he did at Princeton. LeClaire was another guy who we profiled that year, came out of British Columbia, just a power bomber, and we saw that a little bit this year. Just an ultra group of guys that I feel probably had the spotlight on them more than any group of guys I could think of, and they've lived up to it.
And if you believe that there's a cause and effect relationship, then expect the 2018 freshman class to be not quite as good, but expect a lot out of Justin Anasio, the Ohio State face-off specialist, who is presumptively going to replace Jake Withers.
That's an interesting one.
I'm just going to make the point that he was on the U19 team, and then same, even though Matt Moore didn't make the team, the fact that he was the only 2018 to advance through the tryout process to the degree that he did is another guy to keep an eye on heading to Virginia.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, though, but they also have a U19er and Christian Feliciano on the team.
At Ohio State. You're right.
Who was a freshman? I mean, you weren't going to take minutes away from Jake Withers this year, but another talented guy that was part of that class, who has profiled before and will compete with someone like Ignacio.
Right.
And there's also a few Denver guys from the Canadian team who will be playing as freshmen in 2018 as well. Guys like Thomas Semple, I believe. So that's one thing to look at as well. But one thing I really want to pose to you guys is, why did this happen, maybe? Is it just that this is a really special class, or is it maybe something that we can kind of go into and analyze? Is it changes in recruiting? Is it the growth of the game? I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think we just went through what is probably the best theory for why the guys that arrived ready on campus did so. There's the other end to look at it from, which is opportunity. And why were there so many guys that were able to take advantage of the opportunities? Or why were there opportunities that were able to be taken advantage of? And obviously that comes down, I think, to a team-by-team, group-by-group basis. You know, you look at Virginia, where there were a handful of freshman contributors. And in that instance, I think you give a lot of the credit's not the right word, but a big part of the reason is because of a new coaching staff that, you know, probably had a little bit more openness to drastic changes in role assignment than they would have if they had been the group that recruited them and had coached through the, you know, right, you know, three older classes for the previous three seasons. Yale is another group that had a really substantial contribution from their freshman class. And I don't think that obviously they've had incredible continuity among their coaching staff. I attribute that more to the both changes in their recruiting approach as well as how their program developed and the leaps they were able to make during this class's recruiting process. I think you're going to see the quality of Yale's incoming players continue to increase as you advance into the future. So, you know, when you move on beyond that, I think it becomes a lot more episodic in terms of why the opportunities were available. And in that instance, it probably becomes a little bit more common.
Yeah, and if you look at your top 20, your final D1 freshman rankings, it's a really interesting point. You know, I would encourage everyone listening to go check it out, because every guy in this top 20, there was, you know, either an injury or a role that was, you know, made available due to graduation or some sort of coaching philosophy change that kind of made this opening for someone to come fill, and these freshmen, you know, took their opportunity and shoot or shoot.
All right. My final storyline is something we kind of followed all year, but that is the success that new coaches found. And I don't think any of us pegged Kevin McEwen at Binghamton to be the one coach that would have the most success, when it included guys like John Galloway at JU and then Lawrence Tiffany at UVA. Congrats to Kevin McEwen and all they accomplished this year. But what did you guys think of the way new coaches performed this year?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. You know, Binghamton, I think, you know, certainly don't want to put the reason too much at one aspect's feet, but Tom Moore was a program difference maker. But he was complemented by a really well-oiled defense at the other end of the field that, you know, I thought got the most out of their talent. Got an opportunity to see Binghamton play, I think, either two or three times on, you know, like live stream, and then once in person against UMBC in Baltimore. And I was just, it was amazing. I mean, it was a matchup of two head coaches or two first-year head coaches, and I just came away from it being like, both of those teams were well coached. They knew who they were. They knew what mistakes are, and they avoided making those mistakes. And I was just really impressed. The program for me that made the biggest gains under a first-year head coach was Princeton. I thought that Princeton broke out of the shackle of mediocrity that had kind of been its station for the previous three seasons. And while their year-end accomplishments weren't so high that it reflects the positive vibes I feel surrounding the program, I thought this year some of their signature moments, specifically their big win over Johns Hopkins, and then the way they went, you know, kind of toe-to-toe in the Ivy League tournament, you know, I thought that they really comported themselves well, and I was impressed. They obviously had some senior contributors, notably Zach Currier, whose departure they're going to have to account for, but Austin Sims was an emergent player. You know, I was impressed by a couple of pieces that they had at the defensive end, just kind of limiting the conversation to freshmen. I thought Armand McGulchy had a good year. But then obviously, to your point, I mean, Sowers is a building block. Any program, you know, Sowers is this year's Pat Spencer, and they've got 3 years left with him as opposed to Loyola only having two left with Spencer. So, you know, for Matt Madelon and his group, you got to feel comfortable and pumped about what the future holds.
We talked about Albany before, but I think what's interesting, what I find interesting, is a lot of the new coaches were in the America East this year. You mentioned McCune, who I think I did the interview with him when we did the IMLCA convention. He was such a baby face, such a young guy, and that he's able to just whip these guys and then take advantage of certain transfer opportunities and whatnot. But really make a reestablish Binghamton as one of those fun mid-major programs. Plus at Vermont with Chris Fifes. And then Ryan Moran at UMBC, both teams were competitive, I think. I mean, and there's a case to be made that when you looked at UMBC at the beginning of the season, it's like, oh, man, this is a real rebuilding project. And they're able to steal wins from teams like Stony Brook, which was key, and Vermont with a lot of their early scoring and some of their fun wins early. What you like about young coaches is that when they're able to breathe competitiveness into a program and take a division, a conference like America East, and go, okay, this is Albany's, and we just get to the postseason. There's going to be some fun here. Let's have some fun moving forward. That's what I really liked about this class in particular.
Yeah, I think I remember Quint doing a story on this and him pegging Princeton as the team that had the most work, the first-year coach who had the most work to do. And I remember kind of scratching my head at that one, like, Quint, what are you talking about? They got some good building blocks here. You know, Terry, you brought this up, but Ryan Moran, you know, really kind of impressed me. You know, him and McEwen are going to be in the same conversation all the time because they're kind of, you know, you feel like they're neck and neck in that conference. But the way that he was been able to kind of, I felt like he rebuilt his team every week of the season. The team, I don't know if there's been a team under a first-year coach that has changed that much from, you know, February to early May when they played their last game. You know, I think it really is impressive showing what he can do as a coach. You know, he wasn't afraid to search for the team's identity, and I think he found it later in the year. And, you know, I think there's maybe a tendency to go into the year thinking, this is exactly what I want to do, and be kind of have an ultra-tight grip on that game plan. I didn't get that vibe from him. You know, I thought it was more, we're going to try different stuff, we're going to change our mentality from week to week and see where we go with this thing. And you know, it obviously paid off, you know, with a pretty successful year, I'd say, for where UMBC has been the past few seasons.
I just want to shout out John Galloway, because even though they finished their year 3-11, I don't think that necessarily demonstrates how impressive their accomplishment was. This group started 0-9 and then won 3 of their last 4 in order to qualify for the SoCon tournament for the first time in program history. Can you imagine how difficult practice is the Monday after you lose 15-9 to Furman to go 0-9? It's April, I guess the game was on April 1st, so it's April 3rd, and you're 0-9, and your coaching staff is showing up with the belief that you're going to make the conference tournament. Just your entire future is in front of you. Convincing a group of young guys to do that has to be incredibly daunting and incredibly challenging, and he accomplished it. And I think that deserves a lot of credit.
Especially in Florida, where it was probably
beautiful.
Beautiful out, and at that point, you know, there's a lot of other things that you could be doing.
We're talking about Jacksonville here, guys. A lot of Florida. I think we talk about John, though. I think John is, if I were to make predictions for, like, big head coaches in the future, John's someone I would put a lot of money in as an investment. I think he's awesome. I think the little things that he's doing, even in his role in Jacksonville right now, we'll see as innovations moving forward.
I mean, how cool are some of the things that they did with, like, you know, they had the Adirondack chairs on the sidelines for games that you could buy, and they had like the didn't have like a beach party or something like that, like, you know, to kind of kick off. They've just found creative ways to it's hard to cut through the noise of, you know, a college athletics department and make inroads in the community, and they found creative ways to do that.
All right, well, then let's transition to talking about which teams really surprised and which teams really disappointed at this point in the year, looking back at 2017. So I'm going to open it up first. We're going to start at the positive end of the spectrum because Kyle Devitt's not on this podcast, and so that's what we do. Which teams overachieved the most in your eyes?
Ooh, overachieve is a big word.
Yeah.
Because someone like, I don't know if I could say Towson overachieved. Towson was one of those classic teams that all the pieces came together in the way that you would build a program, and it just found its route to a Final Four.
Towson was ranked 11th
Yeah, that's not like overachieving, right? Like, yeah, that I think it's if you're talking about just like profile and whatnot, people will be like, "Well, that was a great underdog story." Not really. That was a team that, you know, there was a building block going back to, you know, 5 years, the recruiting process, 6 years, the recruiting process, and every little piece that they brought on, the Maryland public school kids that got a bunch of attention, having to rebuild the defense, but doing it with some kids that you recruited, bringing in a Woodall last year to kind of fill that final gap of the faceoff expert you were getting hurt. I mean, all those things come together. So, you know, Towson, I don't think overachieved, but within a media profile, people like that story. So there's that.
I think that's an important thing, you know, within a media profile, you know, is how you kind of just said it there. So when you look at it that way, Army is a team that we shouldn't be surprised that they went 12-4. You know, they're another one of those teams that is very good when you know nothing about them. And I think they had that aspect to them that people didn't really know anything about Army this year. You know, the Navy was such a big offseason storyline, and some other teams in the Patriot League got a lot more of the attention, Loyola. Army's very good when it's just kind of cruising and doing its thing. And this year, you know, they had the win against Syracuse. They had the win against Notre Dame. They were the last team, or they were the first team out of the NCAA tournament. You know, they're a team that I think exceeded my expectations, though I never thought they would be bad. I just thought that they were two games better than they, you know, than they would be. And then a similar team, you know, in terms of that profile is Hofstra. 11-3. They had a disappointing end to their season, probably one of the most crushing losses that you can experience, you know, there in the CAA tournament. But their offense was really, at times this season, a lot of fun to watch. You know, they were one of those offenses that just didn't really play a traditional kind of, you know, these are attackmen, these are midfielders. It was very free-flowing, and you know, they did sit on the ball when they needed to protect a win. And but they were a team that I did not expect to be 11-3. I did not expect them to be in the conversation all season to be a contender to win the CAA. And that's what they were up until that, you know, final heartbreaking loss. You know, I thought it was going to be Towson basically running away with it, with Fairfield as the next team there. And then Hofstra emerged as a team that, whoa, I think this team might be better than Towson at times this year.
I was at that game. That was the saddest thing I ever saw. Very few sad games. It was so bad in the sense that, like, Con Cannon, their goalie had been such the hero for them through the season that he had to give up that goal, which was errant, which was a bad decision by the UMass player to begin with to even shoot that ball. But that's, yeah. But you mentioned their offense with Byrne and with the young Ryan Tierney, another freshman who kind of stepped up this season. Really fun to watch, and a good step up for a program that needed it. I think their fan base and their history dictated that they needed a good season this year, and it was good to see that they were able to pull one out. Even with conference tournament play always can be a crapshoot. It's one game that could decide your whole season. We've seen that before in the past, and they kind of got on the wrong side of that this year.
We've seen that before in the past with Hofstra.
With Hofstra, with like even Albany or something like that a couple of years ago.
And I think kind of with this overachieving, which I don't know if that's the right word, but I think what we saw this year was how those teams, those new programs that have the fourth year guys, the guys who started their program who are now seniors, just the special chemistry that provides.
It's a thing now. Whereas, like with, you know, with Marquette last year, it was like a theme and a storyline. But now I think it's bona fide a thing.
If there's a team that's 4 years out from its start, pick them to be a contender in their conference.
Exceed expectations based on what they've previously done.
Yeah, none of those auspices. You're looking at a Monmouth this year and their run to the MAC title. You're looking at Richmond's nice run there. Even a Providence.
Boston U.
Those type of teams. It's cool to see that. And I think that's such a positive aspect of when you're building a program or even when you're selling the sport to somebody. Like, look, you take a group of guys, give them 5 years, you know, with the recruiting process and getting in the school and everything, and you can be winning conference titles. That's cool. That's a great selling point.
You mentioned two programs that I want to touch on as being, for me, the biggest overachievers in that middle class sphere. We ranked Providence 44 heading into the season. There's a lot, you know, not that many metrics to evaluate a team after the entirety of the season's been played. they finished 29th in RPI. So, you know, that 16 position jump is impressive. By the same notion, Furman, we had ranked 63rd, meaning they were 8 from the bottom, or 7 from the bottom heading into the season. And they finished 41st after going 7-8. Those are two programs that I thought did a really nice job comporting themselves this year.
My team is one that I actually haven't heard yet. Overachieve is a bit of a strong term for this, but I think exceeded expectations is Duke. I mean, we look at how young this team was at the beginning of the year. Even Coach Stanowski was like, this is not a plus 500 team. And what they were able to accomplish was, I thought, really amazing. I mean, lost to the national runners-up was one of the scariest teams. About the time the tournament started, I really thought this was a team that could possibly win the national championship.
I'll echo that. But on that note, why don't we turn the opposite direction? Which teams came into this season with high hopes and expectations that you feel like, for one reason or another, just didn't come together?
I'll start. I'll say North Carolina, at least for maybe two-thirds of the season. To start, they were kind of, you know, up and down, never really got it together until about that time of the ACC tournament. I think what really surprised me about them was how out of it offensively they seemed. And it really, you know, came to fruition in that ACC tournament when they started really kind of shuffling guys and moving personnel that we finally saw them kind of live up to the potential that we had pegged them in the preseason.
Johns Hopkins is mine. There's a lot to dissect with that program, and I don't know if I want to get into all of it right now.
It's a podcast in itself.
Correct. Yeah, there will be time for that.
Correct. But it's one thing to lose. It's another thing to get blown out in a first-round home game. And I think that was just sort of the tip. And again, it was twice in two seasons that's happened to them. It's sort of the tip of the spear of a lot of issues and a lot of questions that I think that program really has to ask itself, has to look at how it, you know, approaches roster building, how it approaches offense, defense, everything. Coach Petrarolla is a great guy. I love talking to him, but I think he, even more so than previous years, this is a year where he has to sit down and say, what's my 3-year plan? What do I get? How do I get this program back into a Final Four with regularity? I mean, people, it's hard. Well, I mean, look at what Maryland's done. Look at what Denver's done. That's where Hopkins fans want that program to be. How do I do that? And I think that's what they really have to sit down and do after this season.
You know, there's a few teams that, you know, when we talk about underachieving, not meeting expectations, you know, I look to the Ivy League, and I look at Penn. You know, Penn was a team that I really...
They were like kind of like one of those teams that garnered a lot of enthusiasm late in the offseason. Like, they got popular in, like, December, January, when people started looking at the preseason rankings. They were like, hey, where's Penn? This could be a year for Penn.
I think there was a few of us, and myself in that, who kept saying, you know, like, look out for Penn to be the sneaky team in the Ivy League that comes and wins it all. And they just never really emerge past what they are.
It's funny when we're talking about U19 freshman theories and whatnot. Penn was the other team that had a lot of U19 guys. I think, to me, that maybe, you know, sold me a little bit on, oh, they'll be a good program. They get it. I guess my issue with them, or the issue I would see with them, is they got a lot of lacrosse guys, IQ guys, those type of things that gets you competitive in the Ivy League. But there's a certain next level that you need talent-wise that I don't know if they have. And you know, we can get into, like, the coaching and stuff like that as well. But to me, on a personal level, that's the issue.
And maybe it's just a year too soon for them.
That's a good point.
You know, it could be next year. I just looked at their roster, and it's the 12th leading scorer down is the first senior on the team. So
I actually think Penn falls into a similar category as Stony Brook for me. We had Stony Brook ranked 23rd in the face-off yearbook. They finished the season 28th in RPI, but it feels like their year was a little bit worse than that, whereas we had Penn 25th, and they finished 26th. But it was just like, maybe we just had higher expectations based on a lot of criteria or a lot of things that unfolded during the year, like, for example, Stony Brook's game against Brown. So for me, you know, I just mentioned them. You know, the Brown Bears, who were in the Final Four last year, we had ranked 10th heading into this season. They finished 22nd in RPI. They definitely finished strong. But there was a point in mid-March, or, you know, kind of stretching into late March, where it was just like, man, this team has a lot of flaws, a lot of problems, and there's a long way to go. So, you know, they were a team that I think was disappointing. But, you know, really, the Navy midshipman, quarterfinalist last year, ranked 9th heading into the season, finished 44th in RPI. I think that the Casey Reese injury was outsized in terms of how an injury can impact a team, because I think we didn't realize, I think we realized it at the time, but it was just like that guy handled such a percentage of the load of starting their offense. And they had a good offense, but it was just so dependent on his ability to draw slides. And so they were stagnant after that until, you know, Grayson Train kind of picked up a lot of that slack, but it wasn't enough. And then at the other end of the field, they lost a lot of defensive organization. They still had Chris Fennell and Matt Reese, but obviously, you know, you start the year with a question mark and goal. And I think that one of the things that you can take away from this season is John Connors was a really good goalie and a really reliable asset for that defense last year. You know, and certainly anybody that watched their quarterfinal game definitely feels that way. But now, you know, when you look at it with the you know, kind of clear gaze of 2017, I think, you know, if I'm a Navy fan, I'm disappointed with how the season unfolded.
Yeah, I was about to say we're missing the big one, and that's Navy. And ironically, it's the game against Penn that they lost is where I kind of, for lack of a better term, jump ship on Navy.
There is no better term. I don't understand why you think that there was a lack of a better term there.
That's kind of when I kind of think you started to see, like, maybe this won't turn back around for them. In terms of, you know, another team that was hurt by injuries, Vermont, you know, I think there was a little bit of hype about them, what they could do. But, you know, Ian McKay getting hurt before the season and not suiting up for them. You know, he was, last time we checked, slated to redshirt and come back next season. So he's not in our IL indoor draft projections because he's slated to come back to Vermont. But another team, you know, going with the inside lacrosse cover, Fairfield. I thought that they were going to be the contending with Towson, and they didn't. They just didn't have it this year at all.
The loss of a group of seniors that they had the year before was much worse than I think.
Yeah, we underestimated.
Underestimated that a lot. I thought I saw a lot of nice. Oh, this is those guys kind of helped them to the neck to this level, and then they'll take that jump. Those guys really were holding them at that level, and they took a step back because of that.
17th in face-off yearbook, the Stags finished 39th in RPI. But they still had a signature moment because they almost knocked off Penn State on that game was on ESPNU on Friday afternoon. Like they, you know, and that's one of the things.
And they beat a Final Four team in Towson.
Right. And now, yeah, there you go. And I think you can make a similar point about Navy as well. Like, you know, they had some pretty high highs. I think this conversation does do a really nice job of isolating the issue or the point of parity, right? Like, you know, the idea that you can go from being a quarterfinalist to ranked to 44th in RPI at the end of the following season, you know, it says a lot. Navy made the Patriot League tournament. You know, there were highs to this year, probably none higher than beating Army in the regular season, which qualified them for the Patriot League tournament.
Yeah. And it also speaks a little bit to the limitations of a lacrosse schedule as well. 12 to 15 games. I mean, so much can happen in that time.
Yeah.
And that gets into a
three game swoon can ruin your season.
And that gets into about the baseball. People talk about RPI and SOS when it comes to the NCAA tournament scheduling. So
I feel like this, you know, exceeded, met, or did not meet conversation we could do for every team in the country and would actually be very interesting. You know, because I'm just thinking we were talking about the CAA. I'm like, what about UMass? What about them coming? They lost like the first four or five games of the year. And they put together a pretty good season.
They're
in the championship game of the CAA.
And that point is really important relative to when do you set the starting time for when you set your expectations, right? Like, I'm looking at it primarily through the lens of the preseason. But if you look at it through, like, any interval of the year, because I think ultimately, and this kind of goes back to the idea of storylines, Dan, like, there was a point at the beginning, in the middle of the season, when the storylines were, look how little the prognosticators know. They don't know anything about who was going to be good this year. But then when you look at the All-America list, you compare them from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, they're way more similar than they would have been in the middle of the year. And same with the rankings for teams as well. So on that note, why don't we transition to talking about players? You know, this one's a little bit more sensitive, just realizing that obviously injuries are going to have a significant impact on players who didn't have the years that they wanted. But before we get to that, let's just start with some of the guys. I mean, you know, we've talked about a fair number of the ones who had the most impressive and surprising campaigns, but who else exceeded your expectations that you think deserves a particular amount of shine, credit, whatever?
Ooh, no one really ever talks about Gavin McBride at Princeton.
Great one. Great call.
Leading goal scorer in the country, right?
Yeah.
What was his NCAA stat? It was ridiculous. It was like 4 goals a game. Yeah, he's like that. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's one of those he exceeded expectations or just that he's really, really good and no one seems to notice for some reason.
Well, I definitely think that if it's a function of if it's a function of good versus opportunity, he is the beneficiary of Michael Sauer's arrival in a way that it was very clear, right? Like, absolutely. The opportunities to serve a goal scorer are very dependent on your distributor and the guy who has drawn slides. But he scored 54 goals this year. It's tremendous.
I'll go. This is actually kind of a surprising pick probably to you guys, but I'm going to go with Trey LeClaire. I remember we all got down for a round table early in the season to say, who could be, you know, possible freshman impact guys? And I think I said Trey LeClaire. But I don't think even I imagine how good he could be. You know, one of the things that I said about Ohio State back in the preseason was that they desperately needed to get back their Canadian mojo. They definitely got that back this year between Fennell and Trey LeClaire. But I don't think I, you know, could have imagined the type of impact that he had. And one thing I'm really surprised about is how fast he is at the size that he is. He's almost kind of like a LeBron James in the fact that he's so fast for such a large build. And he complements that with an unreal range shot that, you know, can get up to 110 miles per hour.
A couple of guys that we've already mentioned that I want to touch on, Connor Fields and TD Ireland for me. You know, Fields probably falls into a category I'll touch on at the end of my point, but Ireland, I knew he was good, didn't know he was this good. Two guys that we haven't talked about yet, Ben Pugh and Ben Randall, a pair of first-team All-Americans. Ben Pugh was injured a good portion of the 2016 season, split time with Henry Buongarino. And when he was good, when he played, he was great. But not as great as he was this year. And then Ben Randall, the transfer from Stony Brook, just at times the most physically dominant defenseman in college across this season. I thought those two guys really stood out. And then for me, I just want to shout out a couple of guys who met expectations, meaning they were projected to be first-team All-Americans, and they ended up being first-team All-Americans. But I think the fact that they did it and the fact that they shouldered the burden, particularly given some of the challenges that faced them, they deserve credit. I mentioned Fields. Sergio Salcido and Pat Spencer. Those are two guys that, you know, sometimes you don't get enough credit for meeting expectations, and I think that they really, really impressed me this year.
The Towson crew of Alex Woodall, Taylor Mays, and Zach Goodrich, I think, would be the guys that I would continuously shine a light on. Woodall in particular was someone who had a lot of expectations going into a freshman year, didn't do a much, kind of fell off the radar, comes back home to Towson, and is one of the top 10 faceoff guys in the country, going toe-to-toe with the best in the nation. And really, I mean, his injury was probably a key factor that led into Ohio State's win in that contest. And then the rope unit of Goodrich and Mays in particular. You also throw Adams in, who was good his entire career. But I think Goodrich in particular was the guy that stood out to me, and Mays was kind of under the radar through this season, and then this season kind of put him out there with that crew. Those are the guys that really drove Towson's success in the last 2 years, culminating in a Final Four.
Yeah, I think Goodrich deserves a particular shout-out. You know, he went on to replace his own first-team All-American on his own team, which is really impressive. And also, I just think that both of those guys, Taylor Mays and Zach Goodrich, Goodrich coming from Ken Island, and Tyler Mays, a guy who Brian Kelly had to beg Division I coaches to take, for those guys that go in and have the type of impact they did in their senior season is truly noteworthy.
Jack Kerr in Villanova, guy who
him in my All-Americans. Yeah,
yeah, was one of those guys who was the beneficiary of, you know, a switch position. He played a lot of attack this year, you know, after they kind of rearranged some things with their slow start. But, you know, he made the most of it, 46 goals, almost a 50-goal score. I think that's more than double his total from last year. I'm not exactly certain about that. But one of those guys who I think emerged as, you know, you could argue was the best player on that Villanova team. You know, I think Fracaro certainly has the case to be that as well. But I think Curran didn't get a lot of attention because people may have thought he graduated because, you know, he's a grad student. So I don't know if you know, in the preseason, you know, coaches polls and stuff like that, I don't know if he got as many votes as he should have because I don't think people realize he was there anymore. But he had a heck of a year.
And on the other end of the spectrum?
Sergio Perkovic is a guy who, I don't know, people maybe expect him to be the most dominant midfield force in the country, and at times he went through a stretch where he just wasn't very good.
His career is so weird. It's so defined on a certain level by showing up in the Final Four weekend.
Right.
And then the internet, social media being like, oh, this is crazy. This is insane. And then you look at his season-long totals, and they're good, but I don't know if they're
first-team All-American.
First-team All-American.
Two-time first-team All-American.
Exactly. And it's just, it's a weird thing about this. I don't want to say about this sport. It happens in a lot of things. But, like, those windows of social media, clarification, those moments stand out so much to people who watch the sport and care about this sport.
And I am going to say,
he lives there.
It's also a function of that position as well. Correct. If you are a big, physical, fast, alley-dodging midfielder, every coach wants you on his team. And so when they say to each other, who do you not want to prepare for? You're like, oh, God, we got to prepare for Perkovic this week. We're going to figure out how fast we're going to slide to him, where we want to push him, who is going to be able to go toe-to-toe and match up with him the most. And so in that respect, I think, yeah, for me, I don't necessarily think he didn't meet expectations in terms of his performance, because his season-long totals were on par with, you know, each of mm-hmm. his three previous years of his career. It's a function of the reputation. Mm-hmm. He was a first-team All-American as a junior. There were some that disputed that, whether or not it was deserving. He had basically the same year again this year, and according to the USILA, was once again a first-team All-American. But at the same time, you know, was he the best player on, you know, the number four ranked offense? Was he the best offensive player on the number four ranked preseason team? And did they meet both of those expectations? No. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you talk about expectations, though. Hype comes into it. You know what I mean? You can be a great player, and, you know, LeBron James didn't win a championship this year. Does that mean he didn't make expectations?
So for me, you know, a couple of guys that were impacted by injury, but ultimately I think, you know, over the course of the aggregate of the season, there was more expectations than what they produced. And it's interesting because, you know, one of them has already gone on to do some good things in MLL this year. Ben Williams and Tyler Pace, the faceoff specialist at Syracuse. You know, he was amazing in their season opening game against Albany. And then he left the field favoring one arm and, you know, seemed to struggle for the remainder of the season. And then Tyler Pace missed, I believe, the first seven or eight games of Denver's campaign. And then when he came back, he basically averaged 2 points a game, which, you know, is good for a midfielder, but it is not the level that Tyler Pace had established for himself previous in his career. And then, you know, kind of two central players in teams that we previously talked about as being a little bit disappointing are Chris Fennell and Colin Burke. Colin Burke put up 40 points this year. That's a great season. But when you're coming off of a year in which you nearly put up 70 as a freshman, you know, folks are going to ask, all right, well, did you meet expectations? So those are the four for me that, you know, I would have liked to have seen more from this year.
Denver was really missing that third offensive person on that unit. I mean,
Denver's season is remarkable when you consider what they finished with versus what you expected them to start with, going all the way back to the departure of Zach Miller and Brendan Bomberry.
Yeah, that's interesting. For me, it's the goalie unit at Johns Hopkins, and you can feed a little bit of maybe the whole defensive unit, but the goalie in particular, the goalie in that defense historically is so important to what they want to do down there, and that they weren't able to find any consistency this year. Last year, it sort of reared its head too. They brought in Gerald Logan, who had a great career at Michigan as maybe a stopgap. He didn't quite catch on. Brock Turnbull wasn't the answer, and that really fed into a lot of those moments where they would score 12. I mean, everyone, you know, there's questions about Hopkins' offense, but they'd still score 12 or 14 goals a game. It was then letting up 17 goals a game that really did them in. That position, there's a lot of things to feed into. It goes back to them losing maybe Hunter Sells, who was a top recruit there at one point. But that position is so important for them, and they continuously strike out of that, and it raised its head again this year. That's a big disappointment to me and to that program.
I'm going to go with Austin Henningsen. It's actually hard to sit here and say that considering Maryland won the national championship. But, you know, I think when we went into this season, we thought that faceoffs were going to be a big, you know, critical factor for Maryland. And it started with him, who was a star of the U19 team. He was the starter for that team. And we kind of just saw a faceoff season you know, that was just kind of exactly what it was, 50%. And, you know, of course they got it together late in the season, and John Greeno coming on particularly strong in the NCAA tournament was beneficial to that. But I think overall, Austin Henningsen may have had what we would call the sophomore slump.
Faceoffs have really become the running back position of lacrosse, now that I think about it, in the sense that
300 carries versus 300 faceoffs and the way that they wear you down as a body?
Correct. Like, and where maybe the philosophy going forward is, let me get 2, 3, 4 guys in here and do some rotation on those guys. Maybe not faceoff to faceoff, but game to game or situation to situation. You see where you put a lot of your chips in on the table for one guy, and it comes back to haunt you. I mentioned Hopkins again. Hunter Moreland is a guy who, when he's on, he's good.
Yeah.
He's been playing GIMP for at least for the majority of his career. You saw that a little bit in some of the past with some of the great guys. You mentioned Ben Williams, another guy like that. It's interesting. Henningsen is a guy I interviewed after the U19 games, and he had made that run with Maryland last year, all the way to the championship game, and then he played that summer. And when I talked to him after the game, he's like, "I'm tired. I'm just physically tired." And you know how much of that carries over into a season. You know, it's a tough spot that I think philosophically coaches are going to have to look at and maybe come up with different plans. And maybe that plan that Maryland did this year feeds into that a little bit.
I like the comparison to running back, because where the mindset shift in drafting running backs in the NFL has transitioned towards just give me a bunch of athletes and the best one's going to emerge, and then the second one's going to get some, you know, he's going to get 30% of the carries, and then the third best one's going to get 10% of the carries. I think that you can make a similar analogy in the faceoff specialist position, where, you know, for the majority of the last decade, recruiting a faceoff guy was really hard and really important. And a lot of times you recruited a faceoff guy after he was already in college somewhere else. We saw a lot of transferring at that position. I think going forward, and you know, a lot of folks have written about this, Patrick McHugh and most pointedly, with the increased rise in the quality of coaching at the faceoff position, whether it's on your staff, which, you know, in the case of Ohio State and Maryland came to roost in this NCAA tournament, or just with the ability to send your faceoff specialists to specialist coaching, whether that be the Faceoff Academy or elsewhere, it does level the playing field in the way that in the NFL, it's not simply about production in the college ranks. It's also just about athleticism. You know, it's access to coaching, and you're just going to believe that your guys can get to a certain point after they've arrived on campus.
That's a good point. And I still, you'll still see people shopping the waiver wire a little bit.
Looking at
Division III. I mean, there's opportunities for guys down there to jump up. It's an interesting, the thought process forward with that position.
All right, well, I think that's going to do it for our 2017 expectations versus performance storyline recap.
Lowered expectations.
We really appreciate, as always, you guys checking out the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Continue to come back. We've got our summer schedule in full effect, and we will, before long, start looking ahead to 2018. In the meantime, there's going to be news every week that we're going to be uncovering. We're going to be talking about the MLL on Wednesdays and recruiting on Fridays. So, with that said, goodbye. Terry Foy, Matt Kinnear, Dan Abram, Jeff Shannon. Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.